first case, our second case this morning is number 05-1920, Toledo, Peoria, and Western Railway Corporation against the Surface Transportation Board and the United States. Mr. Eaton.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court. The issue in this case is whether or not TP&W, the petitioner, received the constitutional minimum value for the net salvage of its rail line, and we submit it did not. There has been some issue raised in the briefs with respect to the standard of review by this Court, so I wanted to address it very briefly because it was a very contentious issue in the briefs. We believe that the correct standard of review is de novo because this is an issue of law respecting whether or not they applied the correct constitutional test in determining the value. There are no issues of fact as it relates to the volatility of the steel market, as it relates to what happened below with respect to the process. This is an issue of whether or not a constitutional right has been abused, and we submit that that would be a determination on a de novo review. We also, with respect, while I'm on the standard review, with respect to the decision by the board to adopt this averaging in the time periods in which they adopted, we believe that was also arbitrary and capricious as an alternative standard, but we do believe that de novo review is appropriate.
Why doesn't this case in reality involve a rather run-of-the-mill valuation question where, you know, the board would be entitled to Chevron deference?
Because, Your Honor, this was a forced taking of a rail line from my client. In a force-taking context, I think the case law has been clear, particularly Kirby Forest versus U.S., which we cite in our brief and rely upon heavily, that you must then ascertain what is the constitutional minimum value. And that is an issue that not in all instances, I concede, would be a de novo review. But in this case, we're talking about undisputed facts and a principle and a policy that the board followed.
You know, you jog my memory because you clearly argued against the use of average salvage values for steel before the board. But where did you specifically argue under Kirby Forest for using the value as of the date of the sale? In other words, where in the record below will we find that argument about Kirby Forest?
In the petition for reconsideration, which is the first time that the issue could be raised because it was the first time we were on notice that they were going to use an average or a value other than at or about the date of the sale, we argued in our petition that the board cannot sell the rail line or set a price for the rail line for less than the constitutional minimum value. We give the exact page cite, Your Honor, in our reply brief. We also said that it should have determined the value on the date of the sale decision. That also was raised in our petition for reconsideration, which is really the first opportunity we had to do that.
Now, why would that have been the first opportunity?
Well, because it was the first time that we became aware that the board was going to go back to the date the application was filed and average from that time up through July of 2004 to determine what the price of steel was. We had submitted some information as late as March of 2004 as to the current prices that was responded to by KJR. As far as we were concerned, the board would look at the current price of scrap metal at that time. Instead, the board adopted this averaging system, which was not something that had been argued or discussed earlier. And at that time when we saw that, we said we are entitled to the value, the net salvage value of our line at or about the time of the sale. And we specifically raised that and asked the board to reconsider it.
So I miss something if I believe that TP&W argued below against the use of an average value for the steel, but the railway didn't specifically argue that it was entitled to the salvage value for steel on the date of the pavement, and that TP&W didn't raise the Kirby Forest case until this appeal. I'd be wrong.
No, Your Honor, you're right in one respect. We did raise the issue specifically, and we cite the page numbers in our reply brief where we did address this, that we are entitled to the constitutional minimum value and that the averaging did not set that fair market value at or about the
time
of the sale.
Well, is the reply brief soon enough, in your view, to be to put forth that argument?
I'm sorry, the reply brief in this case. For the first time, the other side in their brief argued waiver, and we addressed that waiver issue in our reply brief before this court. In the court below, we addressed the issue of constitutional minimum value and criticize the averaging, and also said we're entitled to the value at the time of the sale in our petition for reconsideration, which is the first time we became aware that the board was going to be using averaging. So the issue of waiver was raised for the first time, not by the board below, Your Honor. In the reconsideration opinion that we were appealed from, the board did not raise the issue of waiver, that we'd waived that argument. They addressed it. It was for the first time in this appeal and the respondent's brief that they argued waiver, and we replied to it.
Of course, if a rational buyer were truly purchasing the railway for salvage purposes, wouldn't that buyer take into account the probable change in steel prices that would occur while the railway was being disassembled and sold? In other words, how would a rational buyer, because of course that's what we always want, account for the delay and those price changes in setting an offer price? And you seem, the way I viewed your argument in the briefs is that this buyer would just shell out the price per ton printed in industry guides on the date of the sale. And that just doesn't seem very realistic to me. I mean, we are talking about a somewhat volatile industry, it seems.
You're right, Your Honor, but the buyer can walk. If the price is too high, the rational buyer can say, that's too much. The scrap steel price is too high at this point. The board has set the price. I'm walking away. Because in essence, what's going on, and that was discussed in Kirby Forest, when the government was doing a straight condemnation proceeding, is the government had an option to purchase. Once the condemnation had taken place and the price was set, the government at any time could walk away from that proceeding or decide not to purchase. Likewise here, the respondent could decide, well, you know what, it's too expensive, I'm going to walk away. We didn't have that option. And I think to address Your Honor's question directly is that a rational buyer could look at volatility of steel, maybe look at some averaging themselves and deciding, gee, what is it going to be at the end of the day? But recall, the buyer can always walk away. We are forced into that price. And in this case, it's more than just a little bit of tinkering, Your Honors. What we're talking about here is a dramatic difference in the price. Had we been able to sell on the date of taking, which we believe Kirby Forest requires, in February of 2005, we would have had about a $2 million swing in the price of the steel, when we're talking about a total purchase price here of 4.2. If you add in the other issues with respect to real estate, that would be another million and a half. We're talking almost double what we should have received versus what we were forced to sell it at. So it's a significant amount.
Now, of course, by the time the actual salvage work was done, the price of steel would have changed again, and indeed, in fact, it declined after the sale here.
That's, after October 28th, the first sale decision, Your Honor, it did decline prior to February 2005, but it was substantially higher than what the price was set by the board. The board set the price on scrap steel, I believe, at $157, and I think it was still at $195 as in February 2005. But Kirby recognized this. The Kirby case, the government argued after we got through the discussion about the interest, they were talking about the price of timber had fluctuated during this two-year gap between the value that was set at the time of trial and the time that the sale and the government actually wrote a check. And the government said that would be unfair to have to go back and reevaluate it. And the Kirby decision said, but you have to do that, and there are ways in which you can do that.
The biggest difference I can see in Kirby is that the salvage price for steel varies quite a bit compared to the price for land. Land normally isn't one thing one day and the next thing the next day. I mean, time flows.
Right.
And land changes, and steel seems, you know, to be like the stock market.
But, Your Honor, you know,
learning more about steel than I ever wanted to.
That is one of the risks that the buyer who would be going through this proceeding would have to anticipate. And the most important thing, I believe, here is the buyer can walk away. If it's determined that on the date of taking, which is the date that Kirby says we have to look at to determine value, it's too high, they can walk. And there are only a couple exceptions, by the way, to that rule in Kirby, and that is where not where the price can't be determined, which is not the case here, or where there's manifest injustice to the owner. For example, if you'd gone the other way and the price had dropped dramatically and that would be a manifest injustice, you might look at a different measure, or where it's against public policy or the public is harmed and there's a manifest injustice, which appears to be what the government is arguing, saying that we're trying to meet this policy of getting these railroads sold, but it cannot be at the expense of the constitutional minimum value entitled to my client.
Well, but don't we have to really zero in on the congressional intent, which is to keep rail lines up and running?
You certainly do as it relates to the right to take. They had a right under the statute, the board, to take our property, which they did and were not appealing. But when it gets to the constitutional minimum value, that measure has been set by the U.S. Supreme Court, being sensitive to the fact that the government, whether it's through a private party or not, is taking someone's property, therefore you have to pay them the fair market value. And anything less than that is a violation of the Fifth Amendment. Your Honor, I would like to reserve the balance of my time for rebuttal.
Thank you, Mr. Eaton. We'll hear next from Mr. Atkins.
May it please the Court, my name is Raymond Atkins, representing the Surface Transportation Board and the United States Government. The principal argument presented on appeal is whether or not the use of an average for steel prices violated the federal Constitution. I'll discuss the merits of that claim momentarily, but I begin by noting that this constitutional argument was not presented below to the agency. And as your honors are aware, under Tucker Truck, simple fairness dictates that you not topple over an agency's decision unless the board erred against an objection made before the agency. Now, the TPNW argues that they presented this argument in their motion for reconsideration. If you honestly look at that motion for reconsideration, you can see the entirety of their argument against averaging is contained on pages 17 and 18 of that document, and it's captioned as follows, quote, "The board failed to follow its own precedent in averaging the value of scrap steel," end quote. That is a different legal argument, one that they briefed separately to this court, whether or not the board should have followed the LaPorte decision. But nowhere in that two-page argument will you find any challenge to the use of averaging. It's not just that they didn't argue Kirby Forrest. They didn't argue that averaging was inconsistent with the federal Constitution. And the policy behind requiring him to make that argument below is very powerful here, given the facts of this case. In this case, TP&W violated federal law by refusing to provide adequate rail service. And the Keokuk Railroad stepped into the breach and agreed to assume those responsibilities at a price set by the board of around $4 million. Now, TP&W seeks to more than double the price that they paid based on an argument that they, a constitutional argument they did not present below. And we would urge this court, therefore, not to entertain the constitutional claim. However, turning to the merits of the claim, the use of averaging is not inconsistent with the federal constitution for one very simple reason, and that is because it would take time to get this steel out of the ground and get it to marketplace. This is not the taking of a pallet of steel in a warehouse in Chicago. We're talking about the taking of a 67-mile rail line, and any willing buyer looking to buy this property in the fall of 2004 would have taken into consideration first that they would have to get approval to abandon a line from the STB, and that would have taken time. And then they would have had to go through the effort to salvage the line in accordance with the local environmental laws and the like, and then transport the steel to market. And the record is clear that the steel prices were fluctuating dramatically from month to month, upwards and downwards. The board was looking at after the application was accepted, 4 months later it went up by 16.8%, which is when TP&W first put in its first round of evidence. 4 months later it spiked 56.4%. This is when they supplemented the evidence saying you should look at the updated spot steel prices. 3 months later it plummeted 34%, which is when Keokuk filed its supplemental evidence saying, no, if you're going to use updated evidence, look at the new updated evidence, to which TP&W filed in opposition. So that although they wanted us to look at the updated evidence in March when it was favorable to them, they asked the board not to look at it when Keokuk filed it. And Keokuk had attached to its evidence a trade press article, which was titled What Goes Up Comes Down with a Vengeance, and it was a discussion of the steel market and how it was extremely volatile and that nobody could predict where the marketplace was going, because the spikes that they had seen in the earlier months, had the market had responded with a surge in supply.
The board must have had other cases like this where you've taken over. How were the valuations done in those prior cases?
I don't believe the board had ever seen steel price fluctuations of the magnitude it had seen in this case. It did, in support for its decision average, cite two other decisions where steel was fluctuating dramatically. The only case where it didn't take an average was the LaPorte decision. But that case is on a different procedural posture. For one thing, it's under the OFA procedures, which are very tight, and the board has very limited deadlines. So it's not like it could do what it did here and go out and try and get publicly available information for how steel prices had changed.
I wondered, because the board decided to use this 16-month average price to value the steel, and I wondered, why 16 months? Why not 6 months? Is there any evidence in the record of what figure is a real-world, rational salvage buyer?
No, I don't believe there is, Your Honor. I think that the agency had to exercise its technical expertise and its judgment in deciding what period to average. And the most intuitive as a starting point was they had information starting at the beginning as the application was filed, and then June was the last publicly available information. So it couldn't get any more updated information than what it had when it rendered its decision.
Is there any rationale you're using for the date of the filing as the date of the taking?
I know that Keokuk makes that argument, Your Honor. The government does not agree that that's the appropriate date for the date of the taking, in large part because although there are some additional restraints on the use of the property that come into play when you file the application, those are incidental to this whole heavily regulated industry. The most intuitive point for the date of the taking from the government's perspective is the date that Keokuk exercised its option to purchase the line, not the date that they paid for it, which was several months later, but in November, immediately following the October decision. The board basically set forth all the terms and said, Keokuk, you have, I think it was 10 days, to tell us if you'd like to exercise your right to buy this line. They sent a letter to the board saying, we do. At that point, the terms and conditions are set, and all that's left then is closing, which is paperwork and the transfer of the title and the deed. So the most intuitive date is not it's not the actual date of the payment, because once Keokuk exercised its right to buy this property, this case was pretty much over. There was no possibility for TP&W to then sell that line to somebody else or do basically anything with that line except sell it under the terms set by the board. I'd like to turn very briefly just to the standard of review because it was mentioned, and I just want to note to the court that every other court that has reviewed an OFA or a feeder line application has applied a narrow standard of review. That would be the Eighth Circuit and the Seventh Circuit decision cited by in our brief, as well as the D.C. Circuit's decision cited in the intervener's brief. They all apply the customary standard, which is, was there substantial evidence in the record below to support the finding, and is there a rational connection between the facts found and the choices made? And I would say, if you are going to entertain this argument, which we believe you should not because it was not presented below, that the board did offer a rational reason, given the volatility of steel prices, to use an average, as would any willing buyer of that property in the fall of 2004. Two other arguments are presented, and I'll touch on them just very briefly. One of them is with regard to taxes and whether or not the board should have included the value of these tax credits in the evaluation. Your Honors, under the statute, you get either the net liquidation value or the going concern value. You don't get both. So if the property for non-rail use is valued at $1 million and it's valued at $250,000, you get $1 million. You don't get $1 million plus $250,000 in tax credits. The two of them are separate inquiries, and they're basically seeking an apples and oranges type comparison. The board explained this in its decision, and it's correct. So it doesn't matter if the tax credits are actually going to realize, if they're speculative, what the law is on the point. The point is you get either net liquidation value or the going concern value and not both. Finally, there's the question of land valuation. The board applied its customary procedures for deciding who was right on the how much land was owned in fee simple. They object that the board did not permit them to basically remake their case on reconsideration. But the board's rules on accepting new evidence on reconsideration are well established. It requires showing that the evidence wasn't reasonably available when you first put in your case. And there's no argument has been made that they could not have put in a better case in the original case. They took a litigation strategy to try and argue that they owned everything in fee simple. The board was persuaded by Keokuk's rebuttal to that testimony, so it set the fee simple amount at, I think it was about 40 acres, and then applying its ordinary standards for new evidence on reconsideration concluded that it would be inappropriate to permit the new evidence on reconsideration. Unless your honors have any further questions, I will sit down.
Thank you, Mr. Atkins.
Thank you.
We'll hear now from Mr. Mullins.
Thank you, Your Honor. I represent Keokuk Junction Railway, the intervener. TP&W would have this court remand this case back in order to redo a transaction whereby a shipper who had not seen service in over 4 years finally had their service restored. TP&W asked for this remand on a basis of that the only constitutional permissible method of valuing the line under the Fifth Amendment is to value the price of one component, in this case steel, on the date that the actual transaction took place, the line was sold. But then they would value other components, real estate and tax credits, on different dates. They would value the real estate based upon historic prices, and then they would value the tax credits based upon potential future uses. So you could see they have different valuations for different components. So their constitutional argument that they would value things at the date of taking, they're internally inconsistent themselves. And I've searched the Constitution and the Fifth Amendments for a principle that establishes you can have these different types of valuations under the Kirby analysis, and I can't seem to find it, and nor do I see any basis in Illinois condemnation law for such a principle. In fact, we're very concerned that if you adopt TP&W's argument, that the STB would be hard-pressed to find a case where Section 10907 could ever be used. It would make it very difficult for the STB to make the findings necessary, and it would make it extremely unlikely that carriers like Keokuk would ever seek to acquire a line under the statute. And the reason this is so is because one would never know the ultimate price to be paid until the end of the proceeding. The board could never determine before granting a feeder line application whether or not a party was financially responsible, nor would an applicant be able to provide projected financial statements because it wouldn't know how much it would have to pay. Yet Congress required the STB to make those findings under Section 10907 and to do so during the entire course of the proceeding, not just on a particular date. These findings do not lend themselves to the type of methodology employed in Kirby or other straight-line condemnation cases where there can be an immediate taking. In fact, if the end result of this case is a remand with a subsequent adjustment in the price so that Keokuk has to pay two or three times what is already paid, it is highly likely that such an end result would see Keokuk walk away from the transaction and the shippers once again losing their rail service.
I'd like you to answer one question for me, please, because you argue that Keokuk's failure to submit real estate valuation evidence in the initial application was excusable because TP&W Railways railway failed to provide property deeds and discovery, but TP&W argued that those deeds were publicly available records that are equally accessible to all involved. So why should Keokuk's failure be excused if indeed the records were equally available to it?
Yeah, I would take objection to your idea that we failed to present any real estate evidence. We presented the best evidence.
No, I'm just, you know.
Okay, I understand your point, but I would say that we did present real estate evidence in our initial application. It wasn't the best record of evidence because we didn't have time under the time frames that we were focused. We didn't have time to go and do all the deed search and all that. We presented the best evidence of record that we had. When you're dealing with railroad rights-of-way and 62 miles of line, that's a lot of deeds in a lot of counties, and it takes a long time to get that information. And that information is in the possession of the railroads, not in the possession of an applicant like Keokuk. So we presented the best evidence we could. The STB, in their initial decision, said, you know what, you didn't present enough evidence. And they said supplement it. During that period, that's when we asked for the discovery, and we said, you know what? We don't have this information. We don't have time to get it under the time frames the STB has ordered us to supplement the record. You provide it. They provided nothing, even though they had it. And they didn't provide it until rebuttal, to basically rebut what we said.
But if something's publicly available, do they have this responsibility to, you know, basically do your work for you?
Well, they could have rested on just the evidence that we provided. I mean, we did provide evidence in the initial application on real estate values. You can argue it wasn't the best evidence, that you didn't have all the same expertise, but the notion that we presented no evidence is simply not true. In fact, they themselves admit that that's what they were rebutting. They were rebutting our evidence. They chose to put in all the deeds, which then allowed us to come back and say, you know what, they don't have fee. And so you could have, as a litigation strategy, just rested upon our own, you know, evidence that we had presented without the deeds. They are the ones who chose to put in the deeds. So the idea that we didn't put in any real estate evidence is just not true. I thank the court very much for the opportunity.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Mullins. You have 2.5 minutes, Mr. Eaton.
Thank you, Your Honor. Let me address real quick the issue of waiver, which I know we discussed the last time because Mr. Atkins had brought it up. Specifically on page 14 of our petition for reconsideration, in the context, which was the first issue we addressed, of the real estate, we said not only is the board required to provide due process to TP&W, but more importantly, the board may not require TP&W to sell its rail line for less than the constitutional minimum value, which is presumed to be not less than the net liquidation value. And then later, in the context of the averaging of the price of steel, we said that we were entitled to the value of the scrap steel on the date the sale decision was served. Your Honors, the Kirby Forest Court
address this very issue when the government was complaining about the delay between when the value was set and the option exercised, because it had been a couple years and the value of timber had either gone up or down. It was a little unclear from the record. And the court said, we know this may be inconvenient. We know this may be added work. In fact, they even pointed to perhaps a Rule 60 motion where you could reopen the record for this very narrow purpose, to determine the value on the day of the taking, which was the day of the sale. This board, whether you review this de novo or arbitrary and capriciously standard, this board picked the day that the application was filed in 2003, which was over 18 months earlier, and then ended it in July when they said this was the last available public information that we had, even though the sale decision was issued in October. That made no sense. And Your Honor, Judge Rovner, as you indicated, why didn't they choose 6 months? That would have been a better value. That would have given more current value if they had averaged. Now, we submit that averaging is inappropriate, but if they were going to average, at least pick a time period that's closer to the value of the sale, so then we're getting the actual value we should be entitled to. And the board did not do that. It picked this long stretch of time. And one other point I might make, with respect to the delay, everyone seems to be pointing the fingers at TPNW. The board sat on this for a year after all the evidence had been submitted. There were two supplemental submissions by the parties, but that's because this case had been going on for so long. So we shouldn't be punished because of the delay in the time it took for the board to decide this case, so therefore their figures are not current. With respect to the real estate, and I see my time is up, Your Honors, we would respectfully ask that this be remanded to the board to determine the fair market value at the time of the taking. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our thanks to all counsel, and the case will be taken under advisement.